You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
Hey everybody, how are you? Welcome to the Other People podcast. I'm Brad Listy and I'm in Los Angeles. How are you? I have a Sunday episode for you. Dennis Cooper is back on the program. He guested a decade ago. It's hard to believe that much time has gone by. He was one of my earliest guests. And he is making a triumphant return celebrating the publication of a novel called I Wished, available now from Soho Press. Critics are hailing I Wished as Dennis Cooper's most intimate work. The word naked is getting thrown around a lot in descriptions of this book, I have noticed. Nakedly intimate, that sort of thing. It's a fascinating novel of self-exploration and creative diagnosis, or like diagnosing why he's diagnosing why he's lived his life the way that he has and why he's made the art that he has, among other things. And he's just delightful. We had such a good time talking, and that is coming up in just a moment. Dennis Cooper is the author of The George Miles Cycle, an interconnected sequence of five novels. Those are called Closer, Frisk, Try, Guide, and Period. His other works include My Loose Thread, The Sluts, which won the Prix Sade in France, and the Lambda Literary Award, a book called God Jr., Wrong, The Dream Police, Ugly Man, and The Marbled Swarm. I spoke with Dennis over the transom. He was at his home in Paris, where he spends most of his time. He is also a filmmaker. He directs with Zach Farley and has a couple of films out. One is called Permanent Green Light, and another is called Like Cattle Towards Glow. And there's another in the offing that you're going to hear us talk about. So, Dennis Cooper and I in just a moment. The Other People podcast is offered freely. Did you know that? The entire archive of this show is available free. More than 700 episodes, hundreds and hundreds of hours of content, in-depth conversations with all kinds of authors, all available to you for free. If you like the show, if you listen, if you get something from it, if you have the means, you can support this program for as little as $1 a month over at patreon.com/otherpplpod. That's Patreon, patreon.com/otherpplpod. There are different tiers, different levels of support. As you move up the scale, you can get stuff, a coffee mug, a sticker, a t-shirt, a tote bag, a book club subscription. I will write you a postcard by hand. I will wish you a happy birthday. Patreon.com/otherpplpod.
eBay Motors is here for the ride. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly. Brake kits, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only, exclusions apply.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
So Thanksgiving is coming up. There will be an episode on Wednesday of this week. There will not be an episode next Sunday, just so you know. It's the holiday weekend. I'm taking some time off. I hope that's okay. But do look for another episode in a couple of days on Wednesday. And then I'll be off for the Thanksgiving weekend and back at it the following week. All right? So let's get to today's conversation. Let's just get there. Dennis Cooper is the guest. His new novel, again, is called I Wished, available from Soho Press. Such a pleasure to talk with Dennis. Great to have him back on the program. He is one of our finer writers and also one of our finer advocates for literature, and in particular, literature that emerges on the periphery. So I have great affection for him in that way. He's been championing a lot of work that doesn't get championed by the mainstream press or the literary establishment. And we need people like that. So here we go. This is my conversation with Dennis Cooper, and his new book, One More Time, is called I Wished.
George Miles was this kid. I met him when I was 15 and he was 12. And he was the younger brother of a good friend of mine. We were in a band together. And there was this dance at school they had sometimes at our school. And he came up to me and he said, my little brother's on, took LSD. And he's like freaking out. And I had taken a lot of LSD and was sort of famous for having taken a lot of LSD. So he asked me to go talk him down. So I went and I spent like a couple, 2-3 hours with this kid, George, and sort of like seeing him through his trip. And we bonded and we became really close friends, even though we had such a strange age difference. So then we just were immediately like extremely, extremely close friends for, and he was a really super brilliant, super bizarre, lovely kid, just kind of like adorable. And everybody thought that he was just amazing. But then when he got a little older, kind of like when he hit, I guess he'd already hit puberty, but when he got a little older, maybe 13, 14, he got very, very bad bipolar disorder and became really divided into like a person who was either depressed or manic. And it was just really bad. And it kind of stayed that way for a long time. But we stayed friends through all of that. It was rough, but we did. And he tried to kill himself, and he was in lots of therapies, and he became religious fanatic. He tried everything he could sort of to make himself feel better, but it didn't really work. So then we just continued to be friends for a very, very long time. And he was like in love with me, but he was a little kid. So I was not, I was like, that's really moving and touching, but I can't feel that way about you. And he kept kind of pressing that all through the years. And eventually I did fall in love with him, but by then he was 18 and I was whatever, 20 or 21. And so we started a relationship, but then it got broken off because he went to a different college than I did. And eventually in the early 80s, we became friends, and with also a kind of physical component to it. And then, but he got worse and worse and worse and worse. And he became psychotic, and eventually it was very difficult to be friends with him, and I moved to Amsterdam, and And while I was in Amsterdam, he killed himself. He tried to kill himself a number of times. And I didn't know about it for 10 years. And I wrote those books for him because he knew I was right. I told him I was going to write these books for him because he was really, really probably the most, he was the most important person to me. I really adored him. And so I wrote these books thinking they were for him and that he would be reading them and stuff. But then I found out after I'd written the fourth one, just after I'd published it, that he had killed himself 10 years before.
Okay. So, just to interject, like the books that you're referring to are the George Miles cycle.
Right.
So it's Closer, Frisk, Try, Guide, and Period. Those are the titles of the books. And I think it's the body of work that you are most known for. Yeah, I mean, I suppose that would be the case. But I want to go backwards a little bit just to place you in time. You talk about doing LSD and kind of being known for having taken a lot of LSD. You met George when he was 12 and on LSD. Yeah. That's quite young to be taking LSD.
Yeah, no.
and also, what year? Because historically, like, I mean, you must have been among the first teenagers to be taking LSD, right?
It didn't. I mean, it was a pretty well-known drug, and my friends and all I took acid all the time. So I guess it was had already filtered into high schools and things like that because it wasn't that strange.
What year was this, though? This was the 1960s?
No, yeah, it would have been like, let me see. I would have been like 68 or something, 1968.
Okay.
So, I mean, we were listening to the Velvet Underground and Pink Floyd and all that stuff. So, I mean, it wasn't like everybody did it, but the cool people were taking LSD as well as smoking pot and all that stuff. So it was unusual. I mean, I don't know how George ended up on LSD. His older brother was like, was a freak and took LSD and was in a band. So maybe he just did it because his brother did it.
I think back on psychedelic experiences in my youth and how bonded they made me feel to my friends, the bonds that I continue to feel to this day. It's like I joke that it's like a shared trauma, like you just sort of, I'm just curious to know if you think of it that way with regard to the bond that you feel and the affection that you feel for George, both like while he was alive and then also after his death.
Well, maybe. I mean, he didn't take LSD again. as far as I know. I mean, he did smoke a lot of pot and hash and stuff. I mean, with him specifically, I mean, I know what you mean about friends. I mean, I have all these friends that I was friends with in high school, and I'm still friends with some of them. And yeah, we were very, very tight. And you're right about that, about kind of going on that exploration together. And also, like, being an idiot together and being like ridiculously profound together and all those embarrassing things. But with George, I think it was just because he was so lost and everything. And I actually just sat with him, and I think, he was asking me when he was on LSD, I mean, I didn't realize that he was having serious mental problems or biological problems or whatever. And he kept saying, am I insane? And I kept saying, no, you're just on LSD. And he's like, no, I don't mean right now. I mean, am I insane all the time? And I'm like, I don't know. I just met you.
Right.
But he got very deep with me. And he wasn't a person that was very open. He kept a lot to himself. He didn't trust anybody because people would like suddenly be his friend and then he'd go become manic or something and then they'd stop being his friend. So I think it was just that it opened him up so much and we had such an incredibly deep conversation about, whatever. I'm sure we talked about the sky and the stars and all that boring stuff too, but that so in that case I don't know that we would have bonded like that if we hadn't gone through that together.
Right. And he is, I think it's safe to say he's like your muse. Is that a way that you think of him? I think it might be an easy shorthand way to understand him. He's inspired so many books that you've written.
Yeah. I mean, he's pretty, he was extreme. Yeah, I think so. The first five books, those books are for him and the others aren't, but he's somehow always at the center of things for me. And, I wrote this book because I wanted the new book, because I wanted to write something really, really, really personal. Cause I'd never done it before. I'd never written about myself before. And I had to write about him because he's the most difficult, personal, incredibly confusing, emotional thing for me. So he's right there, kind of like deep in my id or whatever you would say.
Yeah, I'm wondering why that is. I'm sure you're wondering too. You've spent all these books. Like, what is it about? And I have, I think we all have people like this in our life who resonate with us extra. You know, like, what is it about George Miles that affected you so deeply? And it's also interesting to me that somebody who had so much trouble forming relationships with other people due to his mental illness was able to form one with you. Like, why?
Of course the answer is I don't know, but I mean, it really, I mean, you know, like I said, the week after I met him, we hung out for the first time, like, and we rode our bikes around and we were like exploring abandoned buildings and things. And he told me he was in love with me and we had this very deep conversation about it. And I don't think he was, but he thought he was, or, but I mean, I think that really impacted me because I think that he was like the first person I really believed really did love me, because I did believe it. I think he did really love me. And I think that was huge for me. I believed it. I trusted it. The way he presented his love, it was a way that I could understand and trust or something. So that was it. And you know, he was extremely smart. I mean, he was smart and funny and weird. And so there was a lot we had in common in terms of interests. And then, I don't know. I mean, it's like, you know, when I used to see a therapist, they said I had this really terrible caretaker problem. And they thought it originated because my mom was like this horrible alcoholic and stuff, but I don't know. But I mean, there was this thing where I wanted to take care of him and I wanted to save him. And that was there too. It was just like, he needed somebody to be there for him and I was going to do it. I was going to be there and I was going to help him and I was going to help him get better. And that was part of it too.
That makes a lot of sense. I mean, I think you talk about your mother and having a difficult relationship with her and then not having the sense maybe that you were lovable, you know, at that adolescent age, or not having a clear sense of being loved and then having this person who for the first time makes you believe it, that's something that would stay with you. And you talk about your therapist. I read that you had been in therapy and one of the things you tried to get your therapist to do was to let you talk about George Miles, and you wanted your therapist to give you insights about him while like kind of taking you out of it, which is an interesting thing to do. It's like, I asked you I asked you all these questions about George Miles. Who was he? Why was he so important to you? And here you are in therapy, basically asking your therapist the same question.
It's true. Yeah, no, it was obviously I was asking her not to not do her job. It was just, you know, I just thought, can't you just like pretend I'm like a television that's like playing a documentary or something about him? And she couldn't do it. You know, it always had to be about me. So she always would only be interested in like, well, what does this mean about you? It was very frustrating, very, very frustrating. But I understand why it just wasn't her thing. You know, she couldn't do that for me. But I thought, you know, here's this person that's supposed to have all this wisdom, right? Your therapist, you're supposed to be like, you know, the big brain, you know, for you, and like supposed to solve all your problems and everything. So I guess I just started thinking, well, maybe you can solve this problem for me.
I think that's fair. You might as well try, right? You talk too about how this book is a personal, you know, you're really delving into the personal in a way that you have not in previous books. Right. And one of the things I've read from you in prepping for the conversation is that you don't let emotions out all that much in fiction. Why? Like in previous fiction. I think this book, you're delving more into your emotional terrain with respect to George, you know, in particular. But can you just talk about previous work and why you take emotion out of it?
Well, I mean, there is emotion, but it's really parsed out. It isn't my emotion. I mean, it is my emotion because I'm the material for the books. But in the other novels, I use it really strategically. It's like I know that it's a powerful thing, and I don't want to use it up, and I want to use it in a particular moment. So, you know, like in the George Miles books, there's usually a point where the young character is in extreme danger, and I want the character the readers to feel for him, or the character is really lost and sad and whatever. But I think really strategically about my writing and stuff. So it's just like, okay, here, this has this effect and this has this effect. And I try to, you know, write them in a kind of way that organize them in such a way that they have an effect or something, which makes it sound like they're really insincere, which they're not. They're very sincere, but I just think about structure and style and stuff when I'm writing, because the other stuff just comes pouring out of me and I don't really think about it. So it's just I don't think about that. Whereas in this book, the new one, it's like, I mean, I had to find a way where I could let the emotion just explode out, because it's very, very sincere, and I was very emotional writing it, and at the same time try to control it. Usually it's like, I don't usually let that happen. Usually it's like, it's just all brain work. And then, you know, like I said, the emotion, I put it here, I'll put it there or something. But this one, it was just like, how do I control this emotion and make the sentences interesting and stuff?
I read that you wrote an entire draft, or at least a significant part of a draft of this book, a different version that, you know, where you were kind of, I think, trying to grapple with the material and grapple with this approach, and it ended up not being satisfying to you. Can you talk a little bit about that as part of the process?
Yeah, I had this idea that I was going to, and this partially ended up being a useful thing to do, because it made me remember a ton of things I had forgotten. But I decided I was going to write a book that started when I met George, the moment I met George, and would just chronologically go through our friendship and our relationship until the point where he killed himself. And it was super, super, super emotional. I was like really a wreck writing it. And I just went through everything, and I remembered everything. And it was like, it wasn't like every time we talked on the phone, but it was like every important thing that happened and how our relationship evolved and how his condition evolved and things that happened like that. But then when I read it, when I put it aside finally, I'd written almost all of it, and a draft, and I looked at it, and it just was dead. It was just like, there was just nothing there. It was just this super boring, I don't know, the feeling just didn't come out. It was really strange. I stuck too much to kind of like a strict narrative or something, and I just thought no one would want to read this, and understandably, because it's just this boring story. So I had to throw it out. And then that's when I started just like, sort of like, I'm gonna riff on this. I'm going to riff on this. I'm going to riff on this. I'm just going to get right to the heart of it and just do all these strange things. Like, I'm going to be Santa Claus if I want to be Santa Claus, or I'm going to, you know, write a fairy tale about James Turrell's crater, whatever I needed just to sort of get in there and not worry about the truth, right? The truth story. So that's what I ended up doing. But that was just a kind of a waste. I did use the very beginning of it in the novel. It's then that night in the book when I meet George and he's on LSD. That was the beginning of that novel, and that's absolutely true, that part. But it was just too rigid. It was too rigid. I wasn't going with my emotion. I was just like, you know, like just trying to remember everything and trying to be really accurate, and it just was kind of useless.
Isn't it interesting how like these things that have such a deep emotional, like lifelong impact on us, like the most important stuff of our lives, you sit there and you carefully try to recount it accurately on the page, and you do so, and then you reread it, and you're like, this is boring.
Yeah, I know, it was terrible.
And I think this is a useful conversation to have for people listening who write, is just to underscore how there's a difference between like telling yourself the story on the page of the tough stuff of your life or the stuff that you can't shake, you know, and telling it to a reader, making it palatable to a reader and interesting to a reader and emotionally involving for a reader is a different project entirely. And it can be hard to get there. You know, I think we all kind of come at it different from different angles. Like you had to like, and correct me if I'm wrong, but the book that I read that you have published, I mean, it's a difficult book. There's a lot of dark stuff in this book, but there, I can feel like a playfulness in the creation of it that I think kind of has to be there. Yeah. And if you're just working chronologically and factually, like, is that an accurate assessment? Like maybe the sense of play as a creative person was absent, you know?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I don't know how it was for you with yours. It's just, I mean, you realize that, yeah, I mean, you have to give some pleasure to the reader, and I mean, otherwise, why are they going to bother? I mean, because they don't care about your fucking problems, you know. I mean, who cares? Nobody cares. I mean, so I mean, you've got to give some. Yeah, so it's like, you know, I wanted Santa Claus to give this long monologue, because I thought, oh, this is actually kind of fun. I mean, the idea of Santa Claus, you know, talking to the world, you know, and it is a goofy idea, but yeah. So I don't know. I mean, yeah. And that's why it changes its style all the time, because, like, you know, I'm not going to let you get bored. It's like, you get used to this, and I'm going to switch completely into a new voice and a different voice and another style, and just to kind of try to keep it, you know, so it doesn't wear out its welcome, really. I don't know. Did you have a hard time finding the balance with yours?
Yeah. And I mean, who knows if I did? I mean, the book hasn't been published yet, so I'll find out. I'm going to find out whether or not I succeeded, but in its own way, it's kind of similar to yours. You know, it doesn't tell a linear story. It jumps around. There's a lot of thinking involved. You do the best you can. You know, it's kind of like the way that I feel about it is that it's very natural to want to write about these things and to want to kind of come to some kind of personal reckoning. But the big challenge is trying to make it a useful experience and a good place for a reader to be, you know, like that's what you're hoping to do, and to make it resonate, even if the person reading doesn't have any kind of like common ground in terms of like shared experience, you know, and right. It's difficult to do.
Did you ever feel like when you were trying to think about making it entertaining, I mean, which is maybe the wrong word, did you ever feel like I'm losing touch with what it's important to me about this, you know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, so many times I spent like a decade struggling with the book. So, I mean, I had plenty of, I had like every possible experience of failure with the book, but so many different versions and so many different instances where, you know, you go to bed feeling like you wrote something good and you wake up in the morning and reread it and just go, oh.
yes.
So I want to ask you about, it's a question that is interesting to me. With regard to the bond that you feel with George, is the way in which a person's sense of connection with somebody can possibly grow in their absence, you know, like after they die. You had this very powerful bond with George while he was here in your youth. But I'm wondering, like, how you would characterize the bond that you feel with him all these years later and all these years since he took his own life.
You know, it's really weird, and this is a strange thing to say, but maybe it is stronger because he's not interfering in it, and that's a terrible thing to say. But, I mean, you know, you couldn't be around George and relax. I mean, it was always, like, watching out for him, and is he gonna like, just suddenly start acting really weird? Is he going to say something really dark and horrible? Is he going to, like, you never knew with him because his mood changed all the time. So having that not be present, I mean, I can actually think about him, you know, and I can actually, you know, so yeah, I mean, in some ways it is. I mean, it's like, but it's also unfair because it's just me. It's like I'm exploiting him now. It's like, because he's not here, and I'm aware of that, and I'm trying to be fair to him. You know, I always try to be fair to him. So yeah, I guess so. I mean, I don't know, but I mean, for instance, I wrote the cycle books. Four of the five of them thinking he was alive. So
right,
you know, and then thinking he would read them and that we would talk about them. So,
and this is a guy who's I guess you said it, like other people could recognize the beauty in him to a degree, right. But it was hard for a lot of people to relate to him, or at least to stay in relation to him because of his illness.
Yeah,
you had, I mean, for lack of a better way of putting it, it sounds like you had a higher tolerance. Like you had a capacity to stay with him and be with him as he was that exceeded most other people's. And this is like, I think this has been noted by a lot of critics through the years. There's a contradiction in the fact that he has been your creative muse and has served as the inspiration for all of this writing. And yet there weren't a lot of people in the grand scheme of things who were really anywhere near as deeply impacted by him as you were. Like, right. he didn't leave a huge mark on a lot of people's lives during his time here, but he certainly left one on yours, and you've built this huge creative library, essentially. trying to memorialize him.
Yeah, I mean, I mean, he had a really big impact on his family, but I think it was an extremely, really terrible impact. You know, I mean, I talked to his mother after I found out he died, and it was very, very difficult. She was just completely beside herself. But yeah, no, I think so. I mean, I got back in touch with my oldest friend a few years ago after not seeing him for 30 years, not talking for 30 years. And we got in touch, and originally, and then one of the impetus of it was to actually, I wanted to talk about George with someone who knew George, because he knew George very well. And, but he was just like, oh yeah, George was weird. You know, that's like, it's all like, and I tried to talk about him. He'd say like, yeah, you know, I don't know. Because I was with this group of friends, and George was part of the group of friends, and George got more and more and more depressed, and he started being like a real drag to be around. And he was. I mean, I know, but I kept insisting to bring him to everything because it was good for him and because it meant something to him, even though he would just sit and stare. And at a certain point, I was taken aside and said, "We do not bring George anymore. I'm sorry he's depressed, but don't bring him anymore to our things." You know. And, you know, and so I was talking to my friend about that, and he's like, yeah, he was really a pain in the ass, you know. It's just, that's basically it. So they didn't really understand. He's like, I didn't really ever understand your thing with George. I still don't, so, you know. So they didn't see it. I mean, they just thought he was kind of a weird kid, and he had a lot of problems, and it wasn't worth knowing him, so.
Okay, so
yeah,
this is interesting, because it's making me think of a question I often ask myself, not only about myself, but just about writers in general, where it's like, wow, you know, I can spend years of my life trying to like untangle, you know, a ball of yarn, essentially, just fixated on something, or not just one thing either, lots of things. And I sometimes wonder, is like, I guess this is what writers are. We're the people who are like deeply affected by things that other people are like, oh yeah, he was weird. And like, to you, he's this like infinite puzzle, you know, right. And maybe that's the role we play. Like we are the ones who get fixated and sit there and make our lives about trying to put the puzzle together or something. But you know what I'm talking about?
Like, it's, I know, like, exactly what you're talking about. I know. I totally understand that. Yeah.
I wonder, like, I guess there's probably no definitive answer, but it's like, are we crazy for being so fixated? And is it like a saner approach to just be like, oh yeah, or are these people just not looking or seeing clearly? You know what I'm saying? Like, that's what I sometimes wonder. Like, have I just wasted a bunch of energy on something that everybody else figured out? You
know? I just think that's the way, I mean, that's how writers get their fuel. It's like, I have a lot of friends who are filmmakers and dancers and make theater and stuff. And they don't think the same way that writers do. I mean, they think very intently about things and they're obsessed about things and stuff, but it's not what we're doing. But I mean, it's like I don't know, I'm sure you're the same. It's just like, I mean, even when I'm on the metro here in Paris or something, I'm just always looking at things and just like absorbing things and thinking about, who's that guy? That guy's interesting. Why is he like that? You know, I get really interested in all these things. And whereas other people are just like not paying any attention at all. And it's just because they're thinking about something else. They might, you know, the dancers might say like, oh, he moves his leg really interesting. It's really interesting way or something. But I mean, I think there's a particular thing with writers that just the way that, I don't know, the way we need to feed, because we're so alone and we make everything alone, and that's like obviously a unique thing being a writer. I mean, like I said, I make films and I do all these other things. I write theater and stuff, and it's like the solitariness of writing is, there's nothing like it. I mean, I guess if you're a painter, it's like that too or something. But I know, I don't know. I think we need to really just like, I don't know, to construct a whole world, you know, to construct this entire world and then like expect other people to like build it in their heads. Takes a lot of really thinking, a lot of really deep and complicated thinking, don't you think?
Yeah, that's what I was just going to say, is that it's like, listen, I'm obviously all in on this approach, but it seems really painstaking, like not to diminish other art forms, but it's like, I think this is why so many people in the arts envy musicians, because it's like, wouldn't it be nice to just write like a lovely song about it or just like a couple songs and then be done with it and to have like that quick to the vein artistic experience that people can easily access. But, you know, there is, I think, a role obviously in the world and in the culture that needs to be played where you have people who are writerly in their temperament, who sit down and really parse the thing and, you know, that's certainly what you've done with your experiences with George. And I'm interested to ask you, especially since this book is a little bit of a departure, but I'm also asking in a kind of comprehensive way, you know, like thinking about your entire body of work. Like, what at this stage of your life and career is your sense of your audience and readership? You know, I know you've been in communication with a lot of readers through the years, but there's that question. And then also thinking of this book as a kind of departure, what your expectations for the work were, if you had any at all, or what you were hoping for in terms of its reception.
Right. Yeah, that's something I'm actually thinking about. I mean, when you have a book come out, I'm sure you know this, it's like, it's very humbling and it's very clarifying, you know, because then you're really like on the spot with your, what you do. I don't know. I feel like I'm in such a weird place. I'm really lucky because I have these people who are really passionately like what I do and are really interested in what I do. And they're not a huge number of people, but they're really loyal and they're really, really great. And the response to this book has been like maybe the best response I ever got. But at the same time, it's like, and then there's like the whole kind of establishment or whatever. I mean, I don't know what I expected. I write in the book, like, I want this book to reach more than just my cult audience. I mean, I say that right in the book. Well, that didn't work. It didn't work because, like, all those places like the New York Times and the New York Review of Books and the New Yorker and stuff, I mean, they continue just to totally ignore what I do. It just absolutely ignore my books. And it's very strange to me. On the one hand, it's like I didn't grow up paying attention to those places, so it's not really like I have a goal to be viewed by them. But there's this weird part of me that's like, geez, what do I have to do, you know? Like, how long do I have to work on this stuff seriously and for them to, like, acknowledge that, like, I should have, like, a column in their fucking magazine, you know?
Right.
So I don't know. It's weird because that whole world doesn't pay any attention to me and just acts like I don't exist or something. But then I have these people who really like my work, and I don't know who they are. I think they're just – it's just like a scatter of people who are sort of weird and I don't know. I'm really grateful for it. So if writers like my work, I'm lucky that I have a kind of a writer's writer thing or something. But so I don't know. My expectations, I don't know. It's like, it's just, I guess I did hope that like this would, you know, get a little, would find people differently than my other books or something. And I don't think it's going to have the opportunity to, because it just hasn't gotten any, it didn't get out there. I mean, you know, you're doing this kind thing and having me on your show and, you know, I've had other things like that. But I don't know. It's confusing to me. It's very confusing to me that the work is. It confuses me that I'm so ignored by the kind of literary establishment. I don't really understand it. It's weird to think that like I've been doing this long and I'm still so radical or something that they just think it's that they don't want to deal with it or something. But I can't figure it out.
I think it's confusing to a lot of people when I think about like books that I read for this show, for example. I'll read one and be like, my God, like so incredible. And yet that book is not getting right. Any kind of embrace. And I have that experience over and over again. And then I think to myself, well, why? Why? Like, is it me? Like, am I some sort, do I have some sort of strange taste or frequency vibration? And then who are the cultural gatekeepers and decision makers who are making like cultural embrace happen, you know?
Yeah.
It's like that sort of thing is where I start to get into a mental tangle, you know, and try, I don't know what the answer is. I guess it's some combination of the ineffable and the material.
Yeah. 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 I mean, I think sometimes something really, really terrific will get through, you know, that's almost like a kind of fluke or something when you see a really interesting book and it actually does get like lauded, you know?
Can you think of one in recent memory that had that ride? I don't mean to put you on the spot, but I'm curious.
Oh, well, I mean, you know, Joey Williams, but I mean, Joey Williams has been doing, I mean, I love Joey Williams, and Harrow got a lot of attention, and I think it deserved, but she's Joey Williams, so she seems like she's in some kind of class by herself because she's like a god or something. I don't know. I mean, but it's strange. Like, it's like, you know, Tech Tao Lin's book got a great deal of attention, you know, which is like, I think it's fair because Tao Tao's a very good writer. So, but I mean, then the other books that came out around the same time that were just as good didn't, and I don't know.
It's like there's only so much room in the culture at a time, you know, to absorb all that's there's so many books, there's so many movies, there's so
especially
many.
Especially right now, this fall has been so many books coming out. It's really been intense.
Yeah.
But ultimately, it doesn't matter. That's the thing, right? You know, it's like, it's really good for your ego, and I guess you could sell a few more copies if those places, like, sanction you, but in the long run, it doesn't make any difference, you know? I mean, I've been doing this, I've been writing for so long now, and I'm perfectly happy with how successful I am, and people respect me and stuff, and I've never had that, you know?
Listen,
I'm fine.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there's no reason to really worry about that stuff too much.
Right. And I think, too, like, you hit the nail on the head. Like, there are a lot of people who really like what Dennis Cooper does. Like, in the grand scheme of things, is it, like, some huge number of people in the global population? You know, mathematically, no. But the people who like you really like you. And that's, honestly, like, that's awesome. You know?
No, I know writers. I'm not going to say any names, but I know writers who are, like, so successful and so famous and everything, and they'll tell me they're jealous of me because I have this, like, cult thing. And they wish they want to have the cult thing. It seems very attractive and romantic to them, you know. And I'm like, dude, you're, like, making so much money. And,
right. We could switch.
Based on your books and stuff.
We could switch for, like, a year and just, you know, let you take a test drive.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
So I want to talk a little bit about the book and its structure. You know, you've touched on it a bit, but it is unique. I think, you know, you're doing a lot of interesting creative things from chapter to chapter or section to section. And I read somewhere where you were talking about your approach to literature and the kind of books that you like as a reader and the kind of art that you like and the kind of art that you're trying to create, where the reader has the experience of wondering what the thing is going to become. It's not necessarily the experience of, like, turning one page to the next to try to figure out, like, where is this going? And, you know, who's the killer or whatever, right. You know, might unfold in a more conventional narrative. But that was certainly my experience reading this book, where I kept being surprised. And the ground kept shifting beneath my feet. You know, I would think I had it by the tail, and then I'd get to the next chapter, and all of a sudden there would be, like, a Santa Claus monologue. You know, So, you know, autofiction. You could fairly characterize certain sections of this book as autofiction, abstract essay, you know, more conventional memoir, all this kind of stuff. Like, it sort of all melds together. So, I want to kind of, I guess, start by asking you a little bit to talk a little bit more about those creative decisions and how you fit the pieces together.
Yeah, I mean, I really like books where there's something about the writing that I just trust it. And then I like them to just take me all kinds of places that I don't expect or I don't even think are going to work. Or I like that, you know. I mean, I like things like that. I mean, like, there's that movie Annette, you know, that Lewis Carroll movie. I don't know if you saw it, but it's, like, it's a fucking mess. It's, like, so full of, it's got brilliant things in it and stuff that just doesn't work at all. But it's such a pleasure because it's so, because he knows what he's doing and he's trying all this stuff out and a lot of it fails, but it has this dazzling sort of, like, belief in itself. So I like that. In terms of the book, like I said, it's like I tried this linear approach. It didn't work. And then I just started, when I was originally, I started working on it, and I worked on it for, like, 2 years, and then I put it aside and I didn't look at it for 4 years because I make films with my friend Zach Farley, and I make these books that are animated GIF, fictions out of animated GIFs. Then I got really interested in that, and I just kind of put those. So it was just kind of a mess at that point. It was just, like, random things. And when I came back to it, I said, oh, I see. I actually was making associations, and I didn't even realize it. So, you know, so it's like when I write this, I have a part about The Heart is a Lonely Hunter and how I related to the movie of The Heart is a Lonely Hunter and how I wanted to write a book based on that, which is all true. And I'm like, oh, well, the guy in The Heart of a Lonely Hunter, he's Santa Claus. He wants to be Santa Claus. So there were these things happening that I didn't even really intend. So it's like, okay, I can create association there. And then I had a fairy tale. And then I thought, okay, this Santa Claus can give the fairy tale. And so it's just started to kind of work together. All the parts started to fit together. And then I had to create new parts to sort of, like, to transition it. But I don't know. This one was a gamble because, I mean, the structure is really all over the place. But I just had to have this underpinning. And one thing, it just relentlessly returns to this thing about George all the time. It's like it seems to go off in something, and then suddenly, like, I get obsessively returned to, like, and then George killed himself. And da, 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 da. So I kind of counted on that being that kind of refrain or something, this kind of refrain running through it, that would hold it together. And just, like, weird style things I was trying to do to make it fit together. I do this thing called internal rhyming where I try to create associations in the books that, like in this one, there's the crater, right? There's like Terrell's crater. There's my head, I talk about when I got hit on the head with an axe, and that's true. And then there's the crater in George's head that talks. There's things like that that run through the book that kind of like unite the book in a funny way. Little motifs, I guess you'd say, recurring motifs. So I do that.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, there's lots, like, the holes, craters, wounds, disability. They definitely echo from section to section or chapter to chapter. And
while
you mention it, I have to ask you, and I'm trying to recall our first conversation from a decade ago, but I don't think I knew. Forgive me if I'm forgetting, but I don't think I knew that your friends split your head open with an axe when you were a kid.
Oh, well, I don't run around telling
I feel like I would lead with that. I'd be like, hi, my name's Brad Listy. When I was 12, somebody hit me in the head with an axe, or however old you were. But that is talk about a traumatic experience and like a near-death experience.
Yeah, it was intense, yeah. Yeah, no, my poor friend, you know, he ended up, you know, getting heavily into drugs and killing himself. I don't think it was just because of that, but he was seriously, seriously traumatized by doing that to me and then running away and leaving me there. It was probably the worst part. But it was you know, just this weird accident with an axe, and you know, luckily it was rusted and he let go of it halfway down, so it didn't chop my head in half. And then I had to go to the hospital, and like I say in the book, I was like lying in bed for a really, really long time, and the pain was just excruciating because they couldn't put any kind of anesthetic in your head. So it was just like you had to live with this pain. And I have a big if you were to feel the top of my head, you would feel this. I have this dip in my head.
Like a fontanelle, like they say in Babies, I think, right? But I think of I'm thinking of Martin Scorsese being like a sickly child and spending time in bed. That's what his origin story as a creative person is, that he had to sit in bed and stay in the house and just kind of watched movies over and over and over again on the one channel that played them, you know, back in the day on early television. And so it was like those repeated viewings that sort of cemented his love of cinema and also like gave him, I think, deeper insight into how movies work. But that's one story among many when I think of reading about like artists and writers through the years, that there was some either health scare or something that immobilized them that factored into them becoming an artist. Is that fair to say for you? I think there's something it has to deepen you to suddenly be taken off your feet and to be injured that badly, come to have a brush with death, right?
Yeah. No, it's true. And I mean, and I write in the book, I mean, I was, and I wanted to die. I was like literally saying like, please kill me, because it was so horrible. And then I got really interested in that too. And that must have had some big effect. I got really interested in like, well, what was it, you know, like I say in the novel, it's like, what does it mean that I really wanted to die, but I knew I wouldn't die, but that's really what I would have really wanted to die. And I suppose that turned me into a fantasist, because, you know, some sort of with writing, you know, and even then I was writing. I mean, when I was like in 10 years old, I used to make I made this satirical magazine at my elementary school that was based on Mad Magazine called Flunker. And I would hand make every issue, and I would do like 10 of them, and I'd sell them to the other students. So I was always like writing and being since I was a tiny child. So I think that probably during that, I don't remember specifically, but I'm sure that I was thinking about writing somehow when I was even going through that head thing. Like, how can I use this?
Yeah, that's good. It's good material, I got to say. And do you still have copies of Flunker somewhere in your files?
Oh, unfortunately, I gave them all to I sold them to my friends. I'm sure they didn't realize I was going to become a famous writer. I'm sure they didn't.
I started a newspaper in elementary school with my friends. and we sold it on the playground. And one of the defining memories of my youth is that we got in trouble for it.
Oh.
We got sent to the principal's office and had to like return everybody's money. And I was like, what? Like in retrospect, I'm like, that was like, we showed some gumption. It was creative. We were like, we made a school newspaper without anybody telling us to. And I was just like, I'm still pissed off about it. Like, what's your problem?
I don't blame you. Oh, well, that's cool you did that. Yeah, so I totally get you.
Yeah, I mean, it was there from the beginning, I guess. But I also want to ask you, I mean, there's so many things we could talk about. I'll let readers discover it, you know. But I do want to ask you about the section of the book involving John Wayne Gacy, the serial killer.
Right.
Because I was so struck by it. And I should say, too, it's about... Is it Robert Priest? Is that the guy's name?
Peast.
I'm sorry. So, yeah, Peast was his last victim, was the last victim of John Wayne Gacy, who, and maybe I should have you describe, because this is something that you lived through and were interested in, but can you just give listeners like a overview of John Wayne Gacy and how he factored into your childhood?
Oh. He was there were like, in the 70s, there were a lot of big serial killers, you know, just before the internet, before DNA, you know, so there were a lot more serial killers because you could get away with it for a really long time. And he was one. He was in Chicago and he killed teenage boys mostly. And I was really at a certain point when I was researching sex and violence and stuff, I was really, really fascinated by John Wayne Gacy. He dressed up like a clown. I think people know him for that because he was called Pogo the Clown, I believe. And he sold, when he was in prison, he sold his art. He'd do these horrible paintings and sold them. And terrible guy. And I was just really interested in him because he, you know, had did it. And it was at a time when I was investigating these things for my work. And the last boy he killed was this boy named Robert Peast. And, he was the first boy that they found. It struck me because he looked, he was kind of like, if I had a type that I was like attracted to when at that age, it would be the kind of Robert Peast, and George Miles looked quite a bit like him. And so I began to sort of like have these sort of like weird fantasies. I guess they were fantasies about John Wayne Gacy and like how I could save Robert Peast or what I would do if I was there, if I was Robert Peast's friend and I ended up there, what would I do? And started going, and I wrote these long things out that I lost. What would I do in this situation if I had the power to wish that I could be there or whatever, what would I do? So that was I go through all the different equations of what would I do? Would I save him? Would I like rape him? Let him kill him? Would I, what I do, I don't really,
But what ends up in the book, and it's just, it struck me so strongly, because it was so odd and oddly affecting, is that in the scene, or in, you know, the part of the book where you're imagining John Wayne Gacy and Robert Peast, is that Gacy has a kind of epiphany. Like almost like a spiritual experience. It was so unexpected for me, and like strange. And
well, it's actually true. It's true. Actually, that's in the book about him. It says that. And then if you ever see this terrible TV movie with Brian Dennehy playing John Wayne Gacy, there's a scene where he kills a boy and then looks up at the light and says, "Light."
Wait, really?
Yeah, it's real.
I had no idea. I thought
I didn't make that up.
Oh my God. Yeah, well, truth is stranger than fiction then, right? Because I was just like, what? But I don't understand, like, this is based on John Wayne Gacy's recollections? Because, like, who would have been there to...
I don't know. It was in a book. I can't remember what the book's called. There's a pretty well-known book about John Wayne Gacy's case, and it's in there, so maybe he confessed it or...
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. That's a super, super fascinating moment in the book for me. It was just like, oh... Because it's sort of the last thing you would think, you know, some homicidal maniac, you know, pauses after killing someone and has like a tender self-reflective moment or something. But it's a weird world, Dennis.
It's true.
I also want to talk, and it's a little delicate to talk about, but, you know, your work, I think people who know you and know your work understand that it can be graphic and transgressive and violent and all that kind of stuff. Something about the depiction... The very graphic and carefully detailed depiction of George Miles' suicide is not something that I often see in writing, in literature, or in film.
Uh-huh.
I also think in like the wider culture, I often bristle when someone's death is announced and they don't announce the cause of death. Do you ever notice that? It's like so-and-so died. It's always the last thing you find out. Well, it's like, well, how did they die? It's the most natural question in the world.
Yeah.
Why do they withhold that? I never know. Yeah. I know that's like privacy or something, but it's like, for God's sakes, at least tell us what happened. And having lost a friend to suicide, I think one of the things I appreciated about that particular aesthetic choice or creative choice that you made is that it's very natural and very human, at least insofar as I understand, to think a lot about the details of a person's death when they take their own life. Maybe to a degree that exceeds other kinds of death. Right. You know, somebody dies of a heart attack, like sure, you might imagine it, but it's just, I don't know. It felt, I was like relieved in a way almost that you went there, because I was like, okay, this is the sort of shit that goes on in my head. Like of course you're going to imagine that. But for some reason, I think people stay away from that. It's difficult stuff to investigate, but you just talk a little bit about making that choice.
That was the last thing I wrote for the book. That part. And I mostly did it because it just needed one last thing and to kind of ground it. And so I felt like I should do it. You know, it's hard to talk about, I guess. I mean, I mean, I don't know what happened. I mean, I talked to two people who knew him at the time and who told me what happened. And then I had to put two and two together and kind of imagine it. So I don't know. I don't know, because I wasn't there, because it's, I suppose there's a part of me that's really upset at myself that I wasn't aware of that was happening when it happened. And I don't know. I wanted him to become magic. You know, there to be this transcendence to it or something. And I don't know. That's a hard one to talk. It really was, even though it's really spare and everything, it was coming from some really strange place. So it's a bit hard for me to, I don't know. It's a bit hard for me to really know why. I just kind of sat down and wrote it and just tried to, I don't know, try to stick to exactly what I thought had to be there. I don't know. That's a hard one, that part.
Well, and it's like probably the most emotionally affecting, like necessarily and naturally the most emotionally affecting part of it. But if you're writing about somebody who you are grieving, who left in that way, you know, I think it makes, from a readerly perspective, I could feel it building towards that. It makes some sense to me. And
It's complicated because he's, you know, because I didn't see him the last whatever 2 years of his life. But I mean, one gets the feeling that, like, that's the thing about George's death is, like, it's terrible that he killed himself. And if they had had better medications in 1987, who knows what would have happened, you know?
Right.
But at the same time, I mean, he was just fucking miserable. I mean, he had already, when I knew him in the early 80s before this happened, he had given up because he had been going through this for so long. Nothing had ever worked. He was just in a terrible state, you know. He was torn into two different people that weren't even like real people. He was just so. There's a point of like, you know, I understand. It's like he'd had it, you know. He just couldn't take it anymore. That he did it in his mother's house is, you know, obviously he did that as an attack, but I don't know. So it's complicated. It's like I understand why he did it, and you know, he shouldn't have had to suffer anymore. You know, I get that. So,
yeah.
But it's hard too. So
it's also interesting to hear you talk. You've said more than once that he was kind of torn into different people.
Yeah.
And yet, like, and you recognize that as his friend, maybe to a degree that exceeded others' recognition. I'm curious to know if, in addition to that, you saw, like, was that the true George, those two different pieces, or was there a true George underlying all that you felt like you had a window into?
Yeah, that's I talk about this in the novel a little bit, and George was very aware of this. I mean, he wasn't ever, after a certain point when he got really bad in his teenage years, he never was like a real person again, because they would give him medication that would even him out, but it wouldn't be like, he was medicated. He wasn't like, and also this happened so young that he didn't have the he was never able to develop into a person. You know, he was a kid, and then he got this, you know, when he was like 12, 13, and then he was never ever a bit. He never ever was right again. So it's like it said, it was like I say in the book, is like it was like these two disparate things being played at the same time. And you you put them together and it unites and it becomes this whole person, but he's not a whole person. He's like, because he wasn't. He would just go from one to the other, one to the other, one to the other. And once in a while, he'd seem kind of normal and he could have a normal conversation, but there was nobody there. Because we were so tight and because we were so close before that happened to him, I think there was this idea that that's who he was, that little kid who was so funny and sweet and smart and, you know, relatively sane. That was who he was. And I think, and I suppose I kept that as the real George, even though, you know, he was an adult later. And I think George wanted to believe that. I think George liked that I had known him before he became like that. And he wanted to hang on to, like, that's who he was that kid. So I think that's a lot of it.
Yeah. That makes sense.
Yeah.
Well, before I let you go, I want to talk about a couple more things. First of all, I want to talk about being a writer who has a varied creative life, which sometimes happens. You know, most of the people I talk with on this show are sort of on a single track. You know, they're writers and that's kind of the extent of it. But as you mentioned earlier, you make films, you make GIF novels, you blog, you know, you've sort of tried and done a lot of different things. And I'm just interested to hear you talk about that and how you assess it. Is it all of a piece? You know, do these different things serve different creative, energies or needs or desires that you might have? Like, how do they all relate to one another? And just what is it like to kind of spread yourself out in that way rather than be sort of like monomaniacal in your focus?
Well, I've always been like that, you know? I mean, when I was a kid and I was writing, I was also drawing, and I built a theater in the attic of our house, and we had put on plays, and I used to have haunted houses in the basement of our house, and I used to organize like carnivals in our backyard every summer. I've always been all over the place. And even like, you know, when I became started being a real writer, I mean, in the early 80s, I mean, I was running Little Caesar Press, was a one-man operation. I was writing, you know, poems and trying to write fiction. I was writing the Beyond Baroque reading series. I've always been kind of like really busy with stuff. And I collaborated with performance artists and dancers and stuff for a very long time. So it just feels really natural to me. I mean, I think of myself as a novelist. I think of myself as a fiction writer. I mean, I think that's what I am. And I think that once in a while that somehow can work with something else. I mean, yeah, but if I'm curating something, that's obviously just a different kind of skill. I mean, the blog is like a curatorial. Like I edited Little Caesar Magazine. I edited Little Caesar Press. I edited Little House on the Bowery Press. I mean, I like curating. So that's a curatorial thing and that's separate. But in terms of like all the creative stuff, it's like, yeah, I think that I'm a writer. And then luckily, like with the films, I get to work with Jack Farley, who's very visual. So we can actually make films together. And with the GIF fiction, I think of them as being, I write those GIF fictions, even they don't look like exactly like I write my fiction. It's just that they're GIFs instead of words. So it feels totally natural to me. And I've never known really any other way. I've always been like that. It's not a problem. I mean, I can do my work and I can do all these different things. And I don't know. I just have a weird energy or something.
Yeah, to me, it's like I do. I've always jumped around, you know. I'm kind of like, what do they call you? Like a generalist or something. And I don't understand how people do it otherwise. Like, how can you be so singularly focused on one thing? Aren't you interested in all these other things? Like, don't you want to experiment? And then I can sometimes like lament the fact that I'm not, you know, more settled into one lane. You know what I'm saying? Like I could sometimes be like, oh, it must be so nice to just be completely set on this one thing and devote all your energy to it. And to, do you ever have that feeling?
No, because I've never been blocked. I don't get writer's block or creative block. I just, you know, if I can't write something, I'll just work on something else and then work on something else. But I've never had a problem writing novels or, you know, it's not like I ever felt like, oh, I wish I had more focus. I wish I had more drive and more I always have those stinks.
Right, right. So no, yeah. I know people can struggle and have like fallow periods creatively or be stuck with a book, you know, like a part of it can vex you or whatever. I've had that, but I think block is, I don't like that term. It feels a little melodramatic to me. Like you got to get to work some way and maybe you're stuck on a certain section of a book. It's good to have something else to go focus on, whether it's another book project or it's a film project or something.
Right.
But I don't like this idea of just being blocked and stuck and in some, you know, state of I don't know, immovable lethargy or something. Like that feels self-indulgent, you know?
Yeah, I don't get it. I don't understand it. So.
And you've lived in Paris for how long now?
I think about 13 years now, but I still go to L.A. just less and less frequently.
Okay, but I pick up bits and pieces about what you're up to over there. Like you have a, you know, obviously like a vibrant creative life in Paris where you're collaborating with filmmakers and you're curate. I want to say I see things that are happening at museums in Paris or something that you're involved with. I'm just curious to know, like, can you talk a little bit about the creative community there and how it has been to be an expatriate and to integrate yourself, you know, into a different culture as an artist and to build community there and to find avenues for your work?
Before I moved here, I mean, my work, they published, I'm very happy that I have a really good publisher here and they publish all my work. So my work was known here. So I came in with that advantage because, that people already knew and my work was whatever, respected or didn't, whatever.
What's the publisher, may I ask?
Editions POL.
Okay.
POL. And so I have that. And then I was already starting to work with Giselle Bien, this theater director, who I write her pieces for her. And so I came in with already things to do. I hardly know any writers, and that's mostly because the most of the really, really good French writing isn't translated. And I don't speak French. Having lived here 13 years, I still can't read a French novel. So I don't have many French friends because I can't, you know, I'm just like, I bet you're really good, you know, but I can't.
Right.
I don't know. So I know mostly theater people, film people, and visual artists and stuff. It hasn't been hard. I mean, I don't have a ton of friends, but I'm not a social person. I like being alone and working, and I like having close friends, a small group of close friends. It hasn't been a problem. I mean, I do all this stuff, and I do all the films and everything. And yeah, we just did I just with Zach Farley and this woman named Sabrina Tarasoff, we just made a video game, a haunted house video game that we showed at a big museum here. You walk through the haunted house video game. So I must, you know, it's like just because I was here and the museum wanted us to do something and we're like, oh, let's make a video game. They gave us the money and we could do it. So it's really fruitful for me being here. I mean, it's definitely been a huge boon to me. Yeah.
It feels like is it like a more, I've always had the sense of French culture having like a distinct appreciation for the arts that far surpasses the appreciation that we have in the States. Like I was on Twitter, I remember after, Jean-Paul Belmondo died. There were clips from his funeral that were circulating where it was like a state funeral for an actor.
Oh, yeah.
You know? And I was like thinking to myself, like, my God, like this is a country that reveres its artists. Like America, it'd be nice to see something similar in America, but we're a long way off from that. I mean, it seems a lot more, I don't know, crass or something, the way the American people relate to arts and culture. Like in France, it's like holy.
If you're an artist here, you know, you're respected. That's a totally very respectable thing to be. And, you know, obviously there's much, much greater financial support for the arts from the government here. And also, you know, people read, you know, people go see things and, you know, I mean, you know, I'm on the metro all the time and people read books on the metro. It's like, and not John Grisham, you know, I mean, they read interesting stuff. So it's quite nice to be in a place where people actually are interested in, and, you know, strange films will open here and they'll be packed, you know, sold out for weeks and weeks and weeks because people are interested in it. It's nice. You should come.
I've been,
okay.
I spent 4 months in Paris when I was 24, and then I honeymooned there, and I've been there one other time. So I think of all foreign cities, it's the one I've spent the most time in.
Okay.
It's great. It's like, I don't know. I know it's obviously, it's a popular destination, but for good reason, especially for people who like the arts. It's such a beautiful place. And it's nice to be someplace where you tell somebody you're a writer and they're like, oh, as opposed to like, well, what do you do? But like, what do you do?
It's really true.
Well, I'm glad to hear it's still true, you know, because it's been a while since I've been there, but it's like one of the last bastions where it's true, I would say. Yeah. I want to ask about the blog a little bit, because this is something that I think in the literary community that you're so well known for. You mentioned it as a curatorial exercise. I think that's accurate, but it's also, and I think this is where you deserve some real credit, it's a place where you celebrate so much literary art in particular, but not just literary art, that otherwise might not get celebrated. You're very supportive of artists, and I think people love that you are paying attention to things that are existing on the periphery, and also that you have good curatorial taste. And this is a long project. Like, this blog has been going on for a long time. I know there was that controversy where didn't Google mess with you and take it down for a minute, and
they killed it. No, they killed it. I had to rebuild it from scratch.
You did. They didn't give it back to you?
They gave it back to me, but it was raw data. So I can reconstruct it, but I have to reconstruct each post and I do it all the time. Every post has to be, I have to find the materials, I have to find the images, and I have to meticulously reconstruct it. It's not easy.
Ugh.
Yeah, they suck.
Fuck that.
It's like,
man.
Google sucks. Google sucks.
Yeah. Don't be evil, right? Wasn't that their motto?
Yeah, well, I know.
Didn't work out.
No.
But yeah, no, it's just like, I guess I just want to like tip my cap to you for, being somebody who just like in a very industrious and, long-term way has been a champion for so many out of the way books or whatever, you know,
that's what I read. The books I support there are the books I read. I love reading that stuff. I really think it's a renaissance in the United States of like poetry and fiction and stuff. I think there's more interesting, really exciting younger writers, newer writers now than ever in my life. So I'm just like this super excited reader, and then I have this lucky situation where I can say, you know, you guys should read this thing, and it does seem to make some small difference. So it's cool. I mean, it's a lucky break for me.
Well, that's the challenge, right? I mean, this is what we were talking about a bit ago. It's like there's almost too much in the sense of like being a fan of books and art and wanting to eat the good stuff. You know, it's like, it's an embarrassment of riches. But what also bothers me, and I think it bothers you, is that there's just all this great writing and people don't know about it.
Yeah.
It drives me crazy, you know? So I don't know. I'm happy that you're out there sounding the bell, you know?
Oh, thanks. Thanks. I'm trying.
Last thing, you know, you mentioned films. I want to say I read that you have a film called Room Temperature that are you going to make it?
Or? Yeah. Yeah. We're hoping, we're raising the money for it now. And it, ideally we're going to shoot it in Southern California, somewhere around LA. So yeah, I mean, if the money raising goes as hoped, we'll shoot it like February or March. Yeah. Okay. So that'll be our third film.
And
yeah, excited about it.
Can you give us any hints as to what it's about?
It's about, really generally, it's about a family who turns their house into a home haunt.
Into a home what?
Home haunt. You know, like a haunted house attraction.
Oh.
You know, like it's Halloween when people, they turn their houses or their garages or their backyards into these scary things, and then people can walk through them. It's a family who does that. But they do it in a place where people don't know what those things are, and so the people in the neighborhood think these people are psychotics or crazy, but they're just building a haunted house. So it's basically about they build the haunted house. You see the haunted house. I don't want to say, because there's things that happen I don't want people to know about, but it gets kind of weird and scary. But it's not a horror movie.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then are there any new books in the works, or are you just focusing on the film right now?
Just the film. Yeah, just the film and, I guess so. I guess mainly just the film for right now. I mean, I'm not, I have vague ideas about a novel, but they're still really, it's still in my head.
Well, congrats on I Wished.
Thanks,
and
Brett.
all that you have going. I'm thrilled to get a chance to talk with you over the transom from, it's so crazy, like a distance of what, like 6,000 miles or whatever it is. And it's, you sound like you're right here, you know? So, I appreciate it and I wish you well on all that you have going.
Thanks, Brett. It's always really great to talk to you.
Okay. That is Dennis Cooper. His new novel is called I Wished, available from Soho Press. You can find him on the internet at dennis-cooper.net, and you can read his blog at denniscooperblog.com. Again, the book is called I Wished. Go get your copy wherever books are sold. If you have anything you would like to say to me, you can email me at letters@otherppl.com. If you would like to support the show, you can do that at patreon.com/otherpplpod. The Other People Podcast has its own official app. It's free. Go get it wherever apps are made available. The Other People Podcast is on YouTube. Did you know that? It has its own official YouTube channel. The entire archive is on YouTube. Go search for the podcast on YouTube, Other PPL, and hit the subscribe button. It's free. The show's official website is otherpeople.com. You can listen on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, wherever you listen to shows. On Wednesday, I'm going to be talking with Sarah Hall, author of the new novel Burnt Coat, the official November pick of the Nervous Breakdown Book Club. That's a hell of a book, and we had a great time talking. I'm excited for that one coming up in just a few days, on Wednesday, so stay tuned for that. Otherwise, I think I'm going to go inside, eat some food, and tuck my kids in. You know, just do dad stuff. Tend to my domestic responsibilities. Step away from the microphone and focus on family. I don't know. What can I tell you?